Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you all here virtually to Bellarmine University for our 15th annual Thomas Merton Black History Month lecture. My name is Paul Pearson, and I'm the director of the Thomas Merton Centre here at Bellarmine. Though it's a great shame we cannot be together in person, hosting this lecture virtually does have some advantages. Firstly, I don't have to be continually watching the weather, wondering if a winter storm will force us to cancel or postpone the lecture. In 15 years, not one has been cancelled. I think Merton must have been looking out for us. And secondly, holding this lecture virtually allows us to reach a far larger audience, and we have had attendees register from a dozen countries and from over 30 states. So a very warm welcome to each and every one of you. We began this annual lecture in 2007 to explore Thomas Merton's writings on civil rights and racial issues. A vast amount of work has been done on Merton's writings on war, nuclear arms and peace, but his writings on racism had largely been overlooked. This annual lecture was started so as to encourage discussion and scholarship on this aspect of Merton's work, which, as with so much he wrote, remains as pertinent today as when he penned it, if not more so. Before introducing our speaker this afternoon, there are just a few brief matters of housekeeping. Towards the end of Chris's presentation, it will become possible for you to submit questions or comments via the question and answer panel. And your questions and comments will be moderated and presented to our speaker this afternoon by Anne Pearson. Anne is a junior here at Bellarmine who completed an honours paper on Merton's letters to a white liberal last semester and recently gave a very well received TEDx talk on Merton, Black Lives Matter and social media. So I'm delighted now to introduce our speaker this afternoon, Dr. Christopher Pramuk. Chris holds the Regis University Chair of Ignatian Thought and Imagination and is an Associate Professor of Theology at Regis University in Denver, Colorado, where he teaches courses in theology and spirituality. He's the author of 6 books, including 2 award-winning studies of Thomas Merton, as well as Hope Sings So Beautiful, Graced Encounters Across the Color Line, a meditation on race relations in society and church. His latest book, The Artist Alive, Explorations in Music, Art and Theology, draws from his many years of using music, poetry and the arts in the classroom. Chris is a lifelong musician and student of African American history and spirituality. He lectures widely around the country and has led retreats and workshops on the healing of race relations in society and church, Ignatian spirituality, and the life and writings of Thomas Merton. So please join me in giving a warm virtual welcome to Chris this afternoon. I'm delighted to have you giving this year's Merton Black History Month lecture. Thank you, Chris. Over to you.
Well, good afternoon to everybody. Paul, thank you for that introduction. I can't tell you how honored I am to be included in this distinguished lecture series that, you know, for 15 years has included not only dear colleagues and contemporaries of my own, but also folks who have been teachers to me, who I've learned a lot from through their work. You know, Sean Copeland, to name one, and Brian Massengale, Albert Rabiteau, Jamie Phelps, Vincent Harding. So I'm just deeply honored to be invited to share some thoughts today. And I'm so grateful for folks who are joining us around from around the country, and indeed, as you mentioned, from other countries. So thank you so much for having me. I want to say a word about my title. Lead Me, Guide Me, the Gift of Black Catholics to the Universal Church. I take the title from a hymn that has been beloved to Black Catholics everywhere for a long time. I think because it's a song that touches something very deep down in Black Catholic spirituality, which I would describe as a kind of a deep down confidence in God, kind of a God-haunted consciousness that God walks with us even through the valley of the shadow of death. And it's a faith tradition that has often left me, frankly, in awe. And for those of you who know the song, I encourage you to hum it along or sing it along with me. It goes a little bit like this.
Lead me, guide me along the way. For if you lead me, I cannot stray. Each day with thee, lead me, O Lord, lead me. I am weak and I need your strength and power to help me over my weakest hour. Help me through the darkness, thy face to see. Lead me, O Lord, lead me. Lead me, guide me along the way. For if you lead me, I cannot stray.
That hymn was written in 1953 by Doris Akers, who during her lifetime was hailed as Miss Gospel Music. Some of you may remember Elvis Presley's 1971 version of the song. If you're old enough, like me, I was 7 years old, I think, when Elvis released that song. And admittedly, my own version sounds more probably like Pete Seeger than Mahalia Jackson, but that's okay, so be it. Like the hymn for which it's named, this hymnal, Lead Me, Guide Me, the African-American Catholic hymnal, it was first published in 1987, and this hymnal is itself a testimony to the depth and the breadth of Black Catholic spirituality, as it rises from the slave songs and spirituals to the birth of gospel in the 20th century and the liturgical music of pioneering Black composers like Richard Allen, James Weldon Johnston, Thomas Dorsey, Grayson Brown, Leon Roberts, Clara May Ward, and Father Clarence Joseph Rivers. What to make of the fact that some of these composers who are gathered together in this hymnal, like Doris Akers herself, are not Catholic? The ecumenical spirit and content of the hymnal, I would say, is one of its most remarkable achievements. Black Catholics have understood better than most that the Catholicity to which the Church aspires extends far beyond Roman Catholicism. The hymnal celebrates the faith journey of a people and of diverse peoples of African descent whose presence in the church has not always been welcomed. As a Catholic growing up in the South, this is when I used to have hair. One of my grade school pictures from Christ the King Church in Lexington, Kentucky. And as a teenager who spent many a Sunday playing the piano for Mass at our church, I knew nothing about this song or the hymnal or just about any of the songs in its pages until many years later when I moved to Denver in my mid-20s and joined a predominantly Black Catholic church and began playing the piano for their youth choir. I had no idea growing up that just a few miles from my church in the heart of downtown Lexington was a thriving Black Catholic church, still thriving, St. Peter Claver. I just simply didn't know. Now, in subsequent moves from Denver to South Bend, Indiana, and then to Cincinnati for 10 years before returning to Denver 4 years ago, whenever we found ourselves looking for a new church to call home, I've always looked to see whether Lead Me, Guide Me was the hymnal of choice in the pews. If it was not, we kept looking. It's not that other hymnals didn't have excellent liturgical music, but the history and the spirituality embedded in this particular body of music has become like a second home for me, a spiritual home away from home, if you will. In other words, without it, I know that something in me as a person of faith would begin to wither on the vine. Sister Thea Bowman, in her brilliant preface to this 1987 edition of the hymnal, gives voice to the God-haunted pathos of African-American faith and spirituality. When she writes, Black sacred song celebrates our God, his goodness, his promise, our faith and hope, our journey toward the promise. Notice the dynamism and the sense of movement in those words, our journey toward the promise. It is the same dynamism one finds in the Exodus story of the Hebrew people set free from slavery and journeying through the desert toward the promised land. Shadowed by Pharaoh's army, flanked at every turn by enemies. It is the feeling of walking with Jesus and of Jesus walking with us as we seek to love just a little bit better tomorrow than we did today. It is the conviction that revelation is not fixed in the past, frozen in the pages of the Bible, but that revelation is ongoing in our lives, God's goodness and God's promise still resound in the yearnings of the people for freedom and in the cry of the prophets past and present, let my people go. Black sacred song, writes Sister Thea Bowman, carries melodies and tonalities, rhythms and harmonies, metaphors, symbols and stories of faith that speak to our hearts, words, phrases and images that touch and move us. Black sacred song is designed to move. It moves because depth of feeling gives it spiritual power. In a very real sense, she says, it is the song of the people. And here she cites Father Clarence Joseph Rivers, the renowned composer of hymns and settings for the Mass. Music, Father Rivers writes, like its other self, poetry, seems capable of doing what plain rational words cannot do, namely to express the unexpressible, to touch human hearts, to penetrate our souls, and to create an experience of things that cannot be reasoned. This sensitivity for the ineffable, for the very pathos of God moving in the world, I wouldn't hesitate to call it mystical, contemplative, mystagogical. This is what Thomas Merton calls wisdom, and the very heart of a faith tested by fire, he says. To live with wisdom is to journey together with Christ, not solving the contradiction, but remaining in the midst of it, in peace, knowing that it is and will be finally solved, but that the solution is secret until it is revealed. The wise heart lives in Christ, says Merton. Because Christ walks beside us, we know that we can and we will endure. Lead me, O Lord, lead me. That sense of walking with Christ is everywhere in this African-American sacred song tradition. In lines that share a striking resemblance to Thomas Merton's reflections on theological wisdom, spiritual wisdom, and the role of images and symbols in religious faith, Sister Thea writes, African people are a diunital people, by which she means both and people, seeking richness of meaning in apparent contradiction. They are comfortable with bringing together realities which may appear contradictory or in opposition, for example, body-spirit, sacred-secular, individual-community. They reach toward unification or synthesis of opposites. She continues, God is like father and mother. God is like fire and balm. African Americans for 400 years have used symbol and song. Have used symbol and song to express a faith and a yearning too high, too low, too wide, too deep for words, too passionate to be confined by concepts. It's worth noting that the root meaning of the term symbol is to bring together, to hold in tension opposite realities of human experience. Life into death, into life again. Rain into sunshine. Winter into spring. Crucifixion into resurrection. And perhaps during these pandemic times, solitude into communion. What we yearn for so much in these days. The music and the preaching and the call and response rhythm of Black Catholic worship mediates a communion with one another in God that is, in Merton's words, beyond words, beyond speech, and beyond concept. I want to invite you to take a moment and in your mind's eye, picture a vast quilt, a mosaic patchwork of images upon images, portraits and tales of tragedy and heroism, all woven into a many-paneled cloth, the living record of a people journeying through history. Now, I borrow this image of the quilt from the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, on the banks of the Ohio River, a place that marks a pivotal crossroads for runaway slaves fleeing the South. And it was just about my family's favorite place to visit during our years in Cincinnati. As you enter the main hall of the Freedom Center, you come upon several vast quilts covering the length of an entire wall, unlike anything I have seen before or since, a patchwork of images and faces and stories, great woven panels, in which one can get lost for many hours. To my mind, it is a fitting metaphor for the Black Catholic experience in the United States. Like the cloak of the young Joseph in the Old Testament, the quilt is multicolored and multivalent, woven of many colors, cultures, nations of origin, and indeed many different worship styles, irreducible to any singular figure or narrative. And so as we move our gaze to the far side of the quilt, we discover 19th century figures of courageous vision and spiritual power, men like Daniel Rudd, a lay Black Catholic who had found the first newspaper printed by and for African Americans. the Ohio Tribune, which he later expanded as the first Black-owned national newspaper, the American Catholic Tribune. Born in 1854, the son of slaves in Bardstown, Kentucky, very near to Merton's Abbey of Gethsemane, and born, in fact, just a few years after the monastery's founding, Daniel Rudd fiercely believed in the uniqueness and power of the Catholic Church as a global, multicultural, multiracial community. Boldly proclaiming from the pages of the Tribune, "The Catholic Church alone can break the color line. Our people should help her to do it." Much like Sister Thea Bowman a century later, Rudd used his voice to build solidarity among Catholics across the color line and to advocate for the equality of all African Americans. In the same expanse of quilt, we find Father Augustus Tolton, the first publicly acknowledged Black Catholic priest ordained in the United States. Also the son of slaves, his father escaped from slavery to fight for the Union Army. Tolton was denied entry into any of the country's seminaries and forced to pursue his studies in Rome. He would return to serve the Black Catholic community at St. Monica's Church on the south side of Chicago, a famous church with a tremendous historical legacy built in partnership with Sister Catherine Drexel. Now, St. Catherine Drexel, St. Catherine Drexel. A wealthy white heiress from Philadelphia, Sister Catherine spent her life and much of her fortune in service to Blacks and Native Americans all across the country. In 1925, she and her Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament established Xavier University of New Orleans, the only historically Black Catholic university in the country. And then there is the Venerable Henriette Delisle, born a free woman of color in New Orleans in 1812, at a time when neither church leaders nor women's religious orders could scarcely imagine admitting women of color to the religious life. Henriette founded the Sisters of the Holy Family, providing care for the sick and poor and elderly. In 1841, 2 decades before the Civil War, Sister Henriette established the first, and to this day, the oldest Catholic nursing facility in the United States. Her creed was as bold as it was simple. "I believe in God. I hope in God. I love. I want to live and die for God," she wrote in her journal. When she is canonized someday, Henriette will be the first native-born African-American to become a saint. Unless, of course, Sister Thea Bowman beats her to it. With Sister Thea, we move to the other side of the quilt, to figures and stories closer to our own time. Born in Mississippi in 1937, the granddaughter of slaves, and educated by the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, at age 15, Sister Thea would become their first Black member. In 1972, she earned her PhD from the Catholic University of America and would go on to co-found the Institute for Black Catholic Studies at Xavier University in New Orleans. Like Daniel Rudd before her, Sister Thea fiercely believed that Catholicism was uniquely equipped to forge healing relationships across the color line. The beauty of universality is that the church is able to speak to people in whatever language they understand best. And we're not just talking about verbal language. You know, she was a lover of dance and of music. Before her death, she said, "I wish I had sung more. I'd wish I'd used my body more joyfully." At age 52, confined to a wheelchair by the ravages of late-stage cancer, Sister Thea famously spoke before the U.S. Catholic bishops about the gift of African-American spirituality within the church. Her words on that occasion were both a gift and an unflinching prophetic challenge. She did not hesitate to chide the bishops for what she called a church of paternalism, of a patronizing missionary attitude toward peoples of color. "What does it mean to be Black and Catholic?" she asked the bishops. "It means that I come to my church fully functioning." "That doesn't frighten you, does it?" "I come to my church fully functioning. I bring myself, my Black self, all that I am, all that I have, all that I hope to become. I bring my whole history, my traditions, my experience, my culture, my African-American song and dance and gesture and movement and teaching and preaching and healing and responsibility as gift to the church." At the end of her remarks, Sister Thea led the bishops in singing "We Shall Overcome," inviting them to join hands. What has become an iconic moment, really, in the history of the U.S. Catholic Church, I think, for the bishops who were there and for so many Catholics who knew and loved Sister Thea. There are so many more hidden saints woven into the Black Catholic tapestry whose names will scarcely be known or lifted up publicly by the church. And perhaps that is as it should be. Much like Dorothy Day, and indeed like Thomas Merton, Sister Thea resisted the tendency of her fellow Catholics to call her a saint, which might relieve the rest of us, she worried, of our own baptismal freedom and Christian vocation to love. She said, "I know people are looking for sources of hope and courage and strength. I know it's important to have special people to look up to. But see, I think all of us in the church are supposed to be that kind of person to each other." This seems to me the pearl of great price in the story of Thea Bowman. All of us in the church are supposed to be that kind of person to each other. I want to share a story more personally. About 10 years ago, when I was at Xavier University in Cincinnati, I developed a new class there called the Black Catholic Experience, a class inspired in part by the memory of Sister Thea. Of the 25 students in the class, about 15 were African American. Curiously enough, none of my Black students were Catholic. Most came from Baptist, AME, and non-denominational Christian backgrounds. About another 5 students were Latinx, another 5 students were white, and of these remaining 10 students, I think 5 or 6 were Catholic. Why should this matter? It was interesting, as I would learn over the course of the first few weeks, for all of my students, no matter their background, for them, the idea of Black Catholicism was something of a curiosity. They had no experience of Catholicism as lived and breathed and bodied forth by African-American Catholics. There are some 4 million Catholics of African descent in the United States. That's more than many Protestant denominations. It's a lot. By far, the country with the largest number of Catholics is not here or in Europe, but in Latin America, in Brazil. At 170 million, 70 million more Catholics in Brazil than the US and Italy combined. The leading edges of growth in the church are in Africa today and in Asia. And yet, as we began the course, my students overwhelmingly thought of Catholicism as a white, Eurocentric church. And the truth is, I couldn't really fault them because their ignorance about Black Catholics mirrored my own ignorance for the first 25 years of my life. About 4 weeks into the semester, we attended Mass together at 2 different Black Catholic churches, both not far from campus. One of these was St. Joseph's on the West End, founded in 1846, where Father Clarence Rivers served for many years. To a person, my students were deeply moved by these experiences, by the welcome they felt from parishioners, the spirit-filled music, the call and response preaching. Reading their journals a few days later, a young white student who had attended Catholic schools in Indiana his whole life wrote this in his journal, quote, "I have seen a different side of my faith that I did not know anything about. I have learned about the embarrassment that blacks felt when the Jim Crow laws were in effect. I have heard the music that made me feel some of the same oppression that African Americans of different times and in my own church were feeling." A young woman student wrote, "Going to church with my class and witnessing people celebrate Jesus the way I do, but with their own black Catholic roots, has been breathtaking. I've learned that you cannot understand a culture by simply reading about it in a textbook. You need to fully immerse yourself in the culture, both cognitively and physically, to be fully part of it. I understand now what we've been reading about all semester." Several weeks later, one of the churches reached out to me to ask if we might partner with them in painting the house of one of their elderly parishioners. I asked my students. Immediately they said yes. And from that experience, a number of long-term friendships developed, relationships I never could have imagined or planned ahead of time. Did we change the structural dynamics of racism and segregation in Cincinnati? Of course we did not. But I would never underestimate the seeds that were planted in my students' imaginations, the flowering of possibilities that they had never before imagined. And thinking back on my own experiences in multiracial congregations, the gift that they received from parishioners on these visits did not surprise me at all. Despite the historical wounds that might have caused folks in Black Catholic churches to turn me away, or perhaps just humor me for a while until I disappeared, the fact is, they did not. I was welcomed as a brother, my family fully embraced as their own. As another one of my students wrote of her experience, "No matter where you come from or what you look like, you are welcome here. We are part of each other's story." I want to say it is one thing to affirm intellectually that the stranger to us is a human being like myself in all the essentials, a person who has dreams for a life of dignity for themselves and for their children. But it is quite another thing to feel our oneness with the other at the deepest emotional level. Indeed, that at the profoundest spiritual level, we are already one, as Merton famously put it during a gathering of Buddhist and Christian monks in Asia. These famous words from the Asian Journal: "The deepest level of communication is not communication, but communion. It is wordless, it is beyond words, and it is beyond speech, and it is beyond concept. Not that we discover a new unity, we discover an older unity. My dear brothers and sisters, we are already one, but we imagine that we are not. And what we have to recover is our original unity. What we have to be is what we are." My students, I believe, were given a taste of this original unity in their visits to Black Catholic churches, and perhaps even a foretaste of what we imagine heaven to be like. The point is, I think it is very difficult to arrive at this deepest truth intellectually through ideas and rational concepts, no matter how smart you are. As it was for Merton in Asia, so it is for us. The realization of this deepest truth comes through direct experience, through personal encounter from heart to heart, in the dawning of friendships with the other. Now, it has to also be said that my students in these visits also had to confront a very painful and difficult truth. that historically for Black Catholics to do the same in kind, to visit white Catholic churches and expect to find genuine welcome there, has been far more the exception than the rule. And that this fact is not just a function of individual parishes, but a reflection of an institutionally embedded culture and history of segregation and racism within the U.S. Catholic Church. On this point, I want to share with you an oral history from a woman named Joyce Coleman from St. Agnes Catholic Church in Cincinnati. I share her story because it presents just another beautiful glimpse at this multi-textured Black Catholic quilt, both beautiful and broken. Ms. Coleman says, "My parents had me baptized Catholic as an infant in Selma, Alabama. My father was tragically killed in 1944, leaving my mother with my infant brother and myself. From the time that I was a child, I was taught that I am loved with an everlasting love. As a matter of fact, I was brainwashed with love in Catholic schools. The Sisters of St. Joseph taught me that nobody is better than I am. God sees all of us and loves all of us. There is no need ever to be ashamed of who you are because God does not make mistakes. Jim Crow had no conscious effect on me in Selma, although he lived all over the place. He would spread his wings and he was mean. There were colored water fountains, bathrooms, entrances, and schools. Consequently, my mother taught me to take care of everything I needed before leaving home. I was conditioned to avoid humiliating circumstances, and to this day, I seldom use public facilities. I built up defenses to protect myself. In the South, I knew my place, so to speak. The facilities and whatnot were separate, but it wasn't until I got to Indiana, where her mother sent her to attend Catholic high school, that I realized that I lived in a separate society. I was in for the shock of my life. There were only 4 or 5 Black children in my freshman class, and Father Muldaney, the parish priest, treated us like we were dumb, ignorant. I was crushed. Coming up, my family didn't have the finances for extra activities, so I read. Reading was my escape. I loved Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe so much that I could quote the verses and soliloquies. I can still hear Father Muldaney telling me, "Negroes don't understand Shakespeare." I couldn't believe him. Well, I did understand Shakespeare, Poe, Dickinson, and anybody else. I thought, do I have to put up with this? Father Muldaney was Jim Crow to me. He told me that I was ignorant and called me the N-word. It didn't mean anything to him that I had graduated first in my class in Selma. Consequently, I put in 150% to excel in school. I got on his last nerve. He wouldn't call on me, and when I earned good grades, he accused me of cheating. He gave me a D in English. I stayed after class to speak with him. When I told him, "God don't like ugly, and he's going to get you," he gave me a detention. See, the education that I received in elementary school was more than book learning. I knew that I was a child of God, and it was difficult for Father Muldaney or anybody else to break my spirit. Yes, there have been times in my life when I wanted to give up, just quit. But through it all, I've learned to trust in Jesus. My life has purpose, and I know that the Lord will get me through. When I share her story with students, I can tell you Joyce Coleman makes a big impression. And when we unpack her story together in class, eventually we arrive at this question. Where does it come from, this inner strength and spirit that empowered her as a young girl to look square in the eyes of someone like Father Muldaney and tell him that God don't like ugly? Clearly, it came in part from her mother's care and hard-bought wisdom. It came from her tutelage under the Sisters of St. Joseph, teachers who taught her as she put it, more than book learning, who helped to form in her the conviction that she is a child of God, a sense of self-worth that would, as it were, inoculate her from the racism she would later encounter in the North, not least from priests and nuns. Same Catholic Church, two very different realities. How does one, as she asks, put up with the inner contradictions that dwell side by side in one's own faith community, much less find the spirit and the strength to do so as a child? My last section. I want to refer here to one of Merton's most mature collections, some of his most prophetic writings on race during the 1960s, Faith and Violence. In those pages, Merton says the following about wisdom, words that remind me of Joyce Coleman and many Black Catholics with experiences like Joyce Coleman. Merton writes, "The way of wisdom is no dream, no temptation, and no evasion, for it is on the contrary a return to reality in its very root. It does not withdraw from the fire. It is in the very heart of the fire, yet remains cool because it has the gentleness and humility that come from self-abandonment, and hence does not seek to assert the illusion of the exterior self." The young Joyce Coleman, I suggest, was able to stay cool and remain in the heart of the fire, not because she chose simply to suck it up and take it, still less because she avoided all confrontation. Quite to the contrary, her strength and her spirit came from the fierce interior knowledge that she is a child of God and that the Lord will get me through. Among Merton's chief models for the way of wisdom were Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and of course, Jesus of Nazareth. To these, I would not hesitate to add Joyce Coleman. The gentleness and humility that mark spiritual wisdom in such persons comes not from passivity, self-humiliation, or flight before the evils of the world. Rather, it comes from seizing on and living from the deepest truth of our inner being, the law of love, the felt knowledge of being loved immeasurably as a child of God. To be brainwashed with love is to be formed in the power of a truth force, what Gandhi called satyagraha, a truth force that no priest or politician or authority of the state can ever take away. Just over 6 weeks ago, on the evening of January 6th, and just hours after a violent mob stormed the U.S. Capitol, some of them carrying Confederate flags, others carrying banners emblazoned with the name Jesus. Father Brian Massengale, who gave this lecture at Bellarmine some 10 years ago, wrote of these terrible events, "What we saw today is a clear declaration that many white people would rather live in a white dictatorship than in a multiracial democracy." Journalist Emma Green, writing for The Atlantic, echoed Massengale and many others when she described January 6th as a Christian insurrection, as evidence that the former president has bent elements of American Christianity to his will, and that many Christians have obligingly remade their faith in his image. Writing 180 years ago, in 1841, Frederick Douglass sounded the same critical theme, decrying the chasm between the Christianity of white slaveholders in America and what he called the authentic Christianity of Christ. "I can see no reason but the most deceitful one for calling the religion of this land Christianity. I look upon it as the climax of all misnomers, the boldest of all frauds, and the grossest of all libels." In other words, what we saw on January 6th is not breaking news for communities of color, what we saw in the murder of George Floyd in May of last year, what we saw in Charlottesville in the summer of 2017, what we saw in Charleston, South Carolina at Mother Emanuel, AME, in June of 2015. These are not new stories. Rather, they are a consummation of 4 years and five long centuries of white supremacy in America, too often sanctioned by the idolatrous trappings of Christian symbolism. Merton's words in 1964 are tragically as prescient today as they were then, or in 1841 for that matter. Many Christians who have confused Americanism with Christianity are in fact contributing to the painful contradiction and even injustices of the racial crisis. We are living in a society which misuses Christian cliches to justify its lawlessness and immorality. From a Catholic point of view, the terrible irony in all of this is that there may be no community better positioned than the Catholic Church to forge healing relationships across the color line. Daniel Rudd and Sister Thea Bowman had it right. And for all of our broken history, this too says something beautiful and hopeful about what is possible for the Catholic Church in the United States as a leaven and an animating force for the common good. I quote here from the late Cardinal Francis George of Chicago. "Catholics in the Archdiocese of Chicago now celebrate Mass in more than 20 languages, making the Church of Chicago more representative of the Church Universal. One third of the city's residents are now either Spanish-speaking immigrants or their descendants from countries as diverse as Colombia, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and Mexico. Race relations in the Chicago metropolitan area have become more complicated as neighborhoods receive immigrants from India, China, Africa, Vietnam, the Middle East, Latin America, and the Caribbean. They add new hues to Chicago's once largely black and white picture." The word Catholic, of course, means universal. And as Cardinal George makes clear, the Catholicity of the Church embodies a unity in Christ where cultural differences are and surely ought to be embraced and celebrated as an image of the multicultural, incarnational face of God. A living journey of faith that looks a great deal like that miraculous quilt at the Freedom Center, a tapestry that is still being woven to this day and well into the future. And so our final panel in the quilt, and my last word I give to a young Black Catholic named Amanda Gorman, who electrified the nation and indeed the whole world on Inauguration Day in the performance of her poem, "The Hill We Climb." Recalling Merton's description of a spiritual wisdom forged in the fire, I invite you to notice the poet's capacity to hold together seemingly opposite realities in one unified image, to distinguish two sides of polarity, not in order to separate and defend only one side against the other, but rather to dwell in the very heart of the tension, seeking to reconcile what is divided with faith, with hope, and with love. I have to believe that both and or diunital capacity in Amanda Gorman comes at least in part from her Black Catholic upbringing, which yields in her a wisdom well beyond her years and certainly well beyond what we witnessed with horror on those same Capitol steps just 2 weeks earlier. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true, that even as we grieved, we grew, that even as we hurt, we hoped, that even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together victorious, not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. And every known nook of our nation and every corner called our country, our people diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade of flame and unafraid, the new dawn balloons as we free it. For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it. If only we're brave enough to be it. So thank you for your attention, and thank you again for being here. And I'm going to turn it over now to Anne for a period of reflection and question and answer. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bennett, and for sharing your words. They are incredibly accurate. As from a personal experience, as a student who went to a Catholic school up until eighth grade, where from my memory there were maybe five students of color, and then coming to Bellarmine, which is also Catholic and is doing its best but is still largely white, there is certainly an element of segregation, maybe not enforced by law, but perhaps by individuals just as we live, that has made this division so clear. Several of our comments have acknowledged this and take hope from the fact that the Catholic Church can break that color line. But I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit more on the unique equipment, as you said, of Roman Catholicism that makes it possible to reach across that color line. What is it specifically about Catholicism that gives us the ability to really make those connections and move forward from where we are now?
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Anne. That's a great question, and thanks to the questioner for that. I would say two things, and there's much more to say, but you know, one of the things that struck me in my own study of the history of Black Catholics. So I want to share this. This is a classic by Cyprian Davis. Other wonderful volumes that I use in my own teaching, for example, this edited volume by Sean Copeland called Uncommon Faithfulness, The Black Catholic Experience. One other that I've used, Albert Rabiteau, Canaanland, A Religious History of African Americans. When you go down deep into the roots of slave spirituality, you know, when you ask the question, well, what is it in Christianity that slaves were drawn to? And in particular, perhaps, what is it in Catholicism that African Americans were drawn to? And one thing that really struck me in my own study was the degree to which the spirit religions, if you will, of Africa resonated a lot with that Catholic sense of the cloud of witnesses, the living dead, communion with the dead. There's a sort of a permeability in our relationship with the dead in Catholicism. All of our statues and icons and the rest speak to a world, right, in which the dead are not simply dead, but they still walk with us. The ancestors matter. They walk with us. We pray to them. We ask for their intercession. And there's a great deal in common, I think, with that sense of reverence for the ancestors in African religions, in the very roots of slave spirituality. And so you see this blending under the hush arbors at night in the praise houses, when Blacks at the end of the day would come together, often in secret, to pray and worship and dance what's known as the ring shout, right? And so there was a tremendous appeal to evangelical Christianity, but I think as well to Catholic Christianity in the slave communities because of this sense of communion with the ancestors that is so alive in Black Catholic spirituality as well. I think to pull it into the present, you know, I could be accused of being idealistic, but, you know, think about that quote I shared from Father, from Cardinal George of Chicago. It seems to me that, and we have evidence for this in the civil rights movement, much of the energy for the civil rights movement came out of the churches, And I think if there is hope for the future of the U.S. Catholic Church, for breaking that barrier that King famously described, 11 o'clock Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America, I think Catholics could go a long way to reaching out, opening their doors to other communities, building relationships across the color line. Some Catholic churches have been forced to do that by the consolidation of parishes and coming together across different cultural differences. And that can be, no doubt, a very painful, difficult kind of experience. The shortage, the priest shortage, has necessitated the closing of parishes. In Cincinnati, for example, some years ago, five different Black Catholic churches were consolidated into one single parish. And just imagine that that took many years to make that happen, and the pain and sort of letting go of my home church, the history, the memory, all of it. But out of that dying, I suggest something beautiful comes to birth, can come to birth, in the forging of relationships across these historical and racial and economic, frankly, differences. Again, I could be accused of sort of being idealistic, but I've seen it, and I want to believe that our faith is larger than those things that do divide us historically, racially, economically.
Thank you so much, Dr. Premack. You mentioned in your answer there the first civil rights movement and the ways that they called for unity. And of course, I think we couldn't have this conversation without mentioning that we are living through another civil rights movement with the Black Lives Matter marches and their calls for unity. And we had a question specifically about the Black Lives Matter and their calls for liaisons between the Black Liberation Movement, the Catholic Church, and for specifically Catholic bishops to reach out and engage in conversation. And someone asked, what and who do you believe can best facilitate these conversations and conversion?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. I mean, the more the merrier, the more the better, right? This is a multifaceted invitation. I would even use the word vocation, that the vocation of the Catholic Church to be a leader and not a follower in this respect. I think too often, sadly, we have been way behind the eight ball on being out front in terms of a movement for racial justice. Nobody has probably said that better than Brian Massengale in his book, Racial Justice in the Catholic Church, both a deeply personal reflection, but also a systematic, deeply thoughtful reflection on structures of racism within the Catholic Church. I think, you know, there, in my experience over the last 10 years or so since my book on race was published, I found that it is important to have so-called white allies in the movement, white voices speaking primarily to white audiences. For better or worse, often white voices sometimes carry weight. I've had students say to me, you know, that really sucks, that whites tend not to listen to people of color, or tend to think to themselves, well, you have skin in the game, so that's why you're angry. Well, the truth is we all have skin in the game. We all have skin in the game. God has skin in the game, if I could put it that way, from a theological point of view. And so we need kind of all hands on deck. I think the Black Catholic voices have been extremely powerful. Father Massengale, one of them, Sean Copeland, another. Younger scholars like Andrew Prevost, who spoke for Bellarmine last year, I believe. And so it's extremely important for white folks to hear and listen to people of color in their midst, scholars, parishioners, to create venues of hospitality, of welcome, where we can simply come together, share a meal, and just listen to each other's stories. Sister Thea Bowman was a great model for that kind of face-to-face personal encounter, I think, which is really, really important. There's a couple of churches in Philadelphia after the death of George, the murder of George Floyd, traditionally a black Catholic church. I was just reading about this the other day, and a white Catholic church, since that happened, have organized Zoom conferences around racial justice. They've come together to talk to each other and hear each other's stories. I think those kind of moments of reaching out, of hospitality, and of just opportunities for deep listening face to face are really, really important. At the structural level, I think the church has a lot of work to do in terms of teaching their young people the history of Black Catholic spirituality, Black Catholic witness, for 400 years in this country. It's an embarrassment to me that I knew nothing about Sister Thea Bowman during her lifetime. I'm embarrassed to admit it. It's not that my teachers at my own Catholic church or school were people of bad will, or of bad conscience, but there was a profound gap in their own awareness of the Black Catholic Church experience. And so I see it as a failure institutionally to recognize the richness right under our noses. It's not, we don't have to go to Latin America, although that's a good thing too, right? But right here, right, probably 10 minutes from my university here in Denver, less than, is a Black Catholic church. Several, in fact, 10, 15 minutes on the east side of Denver. So we can make efforts to get ourselves out of the classroom, get ourselves out of our parish halls, and to invite people to come together and share our stories.
Thank you. I definitely like your point that conversation is where we have to start, because I'm a strong proponent of the idea that structural change starts at the bottom, that until we've started to have those conversations, we can't move forward. Another question in the chat, though, was we live as in a very divided society, and specifically in the church, it is still very divided politically. Do you have any tips to have these conversations across political divides? To actually be able to reach out without bringing anger, without bringing judgment, to educate people and to share ideas?
Yeah, thank you for that very good question. I don't know that there's any magic bullet. It's hard. It's hard in our own families, right? Our own families are divided politically, our churches. I mentioned a moment ago those two churches in Philadelphia. I mean, there's a priest at one of those, at the white church, who went out and marched with the Black Lives Matter movement, and some of his parishioners were outraged, scandalized that he would dare go out and march with Black Lives Matter protesters. I don't pretend that it's easy. I do ask people whenever we're coming together, sort of, for example, in more formal settings like this, or in the classroom, to do their homework. Before we pronounce politically on our blogs or on our websites or at the dinner table, I think it's really important for people to educate themselves. I think it's good news that some of the titles around racial justice are bestsellers right now on the New York Times bestseller list. And in the Catholic world, many of the volumes published by Orbis Books, for example, like this one, like Brian Massengale's work, James Cone's work. White folks, I think, of goodwill are sincerely reaching out. There has been a kind of a wake up, a reckoning among white folks since the death of George Floyd. I don't know exactly how to get past the political divide, and I just pray I pray that the more we're willing to do a little bit of homework of self-education, and above all, if you're white, for white folks, to educate yourself and to listen deeply to the experience of communities of color. We have to find a way to get out of our echo chambers, our bubbles, which are comfortable and familiar to us. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that, Anne, or anybody else on the call. But Anne, I guess, what have you seen at Bellarmine in terms of your classmates and colleagues? Have you found it, you've been able to have discourse across those divides?
It's certainly tricky. And it's actually not a skill that I really learned up until this year, which is a shame to say, but I went to a very, very liberal high school. So I was surrounded by people who had the same perspectives that I did. And it wasn't at Bellarmine that I learned to do it, but rather through an organization that I'm a part of that specifically brings together people from different political perspectives to have discussion. Mm. And it actually meant that I had to sit down and understand people's concerns and understand the basis of why they were reacting the way they did. So certainly some of the more conservative members weren't a big fan of Black Lives Matter because the stories that they were hearing were ones of destruction. Even if it wasn't widespread, that was what was getting through. And to hear their concerns on that front and acknowledge them and then speak back to them and be like, this is, I understand where you're coming from, here's where I'm coming from, has helped a lot. But it does, it really takes listening to the other person first, which can be rather uncomfortable.
And exactly, and more than one occasion. So over time. So where this has worked in parishes, it works because it takes place over time. You don't expect to work miracles in a one-off event. And so one of the great promises, I think, of the classroom and joys of being a teacher is you build relationships over time and you develop trust over time. And I've had some tremendous kind of moments of breakthrough in the classroom, but also tremendous moments that were quite explosive between students. And I think what I've learned is that there is really no way around that if you're going to go beneath the superficial and the nice things that we say to each other in public and to really share stories that get us beneath the superficial and help us understand where people are coming from, what is it in their own past or experience. As you said, Anne, what is it that lends people to have that prejudice around Black Lives Matter, for example, or that prejudgment, right, around Black Lives Matter when they may not have ever met a person who's involved with that movement?
Yes, I feel like conversation across the lines is certainly one of the most important things. But one of the quotes that struck me the most from a Louisville activist, actually, her name is Hannah Drake. She's a wonderful poet. I definitely recommend looking up her work, is that white people can't just admit or can't just study our way out of racism. It's a good first step. We have to educate ourselves because otherwise it doesn't go anywhere. Merton said that. But once we've faced that, what's the next step? After we've admitted that we do have privilege, what is something that you'd like to see the Catholic Church actually do to combat racism in our own ranks and then in our society? Is there any changes you've seen in your own parishes or across the country that you think is really effective?
Well, thank you for that question. Archbishop Wilton Gregory just came to mind because he gave, he's now the Cardinal Wilton Gregory of Washington, D.C., just gave an interview with, I think, Al Roker on CBS News. You can find it online. It's really a beautiful interview. He kind of comes back to this idea of listening to each other, deep listening. The seminaries under our previous several popes, I would say, unfortunately, their curricula have largely not to put it charitably, have not been terribly aligned with the spirit of the content of Vatican II. nor with the best in theology in the last 40 or 50 years, you know. Our seminary training, I think, is sadly wanting, at least in the diocesan realm. I think it's a different story in the religious orders. Many of the religious orders have done better in their training of young priests, women religious, and so forth. Why do I mention that? Because I think Anne, as much as I totally agree with you about that, from the bottom up, that's how cultural change happens. It also happens from the top down, insofar as our leadership sets a spirit, sets a tone, right? And I think Pope Francis is a fantastic example of that. I think many of us have felt like we could finally exhale a little bit in the last 5 or 6 years under Pope Francis, right? And it's not accidental that he comes out of the Latin American church and that he spent much of his life as a priest, right, among the poor, among the disenfranchised. And so both from the bottom up, you know, people have to begin to think and imagine outside the box. What are the churches within 5-10 miles of my church that I don't know who's there? You know, I have never met them. Pick up the phone, make some phone calls, reach out. Events of hospitality, the simplest acts of hospitality can yield beautiful fruit over time if we open ourselves, if we're vulnerable to those kinds of invitations. So I would love to see the church lift up more saints, people of color from our own history, the leadership, the training, but also I would love to see lay Catholics like Daniel Rudd begin to imagine big and bold and beautiful about how to throw out those invitations and begin to initiate conversations across those boundaries, geographical and otherwise.
I love that you mentioned Pope Francis, because I do think that he has made a significant change to the church, at least on that front, forcing us to be more open. I think we probably have time for one more question before we turn it back over to Dr. Pearson for the closing remarks. As I'm sitting here in the Thomas Merton Center Thomas Merton peeping over my shoulder here, his words are very inspirational as far as reaching out across those dividing lines and speaking to others around us. Is there anything in particular of his words that inspired you to reach across the dividing line and look more into Black Catholicism and what it means for the church as a whole?
I have a dear friend back in Cincinnati who was growing up in the 60s, a young woman coming of age in the 60s, who was a nun, a Black Catholic nun. And I'll never forget her coming up to me after one of my talks at the parish on Thomas Merton. And she was holding Merton's book, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. And she looked me in the eyes and she said, you know, this book was my Bible in the 1960s. Merton got it when few others did. By which I took her to mean few other of her white Catholic fellow Catholics, whether in her religious order or in the parishes and so forth. That without question, Merton inspired many, many folks, peace activists in the movement for racial justice. I think as a young kid, I would put it maybe more broadly, you know, even as a young kid, before I got concerned with racial justice, before I had the experience of crossing over into African-American churches in my 20s, Merton taught me, by reading Merton, he taught me that it was okay. In fact, it was more than okay. It was that we had something to learn about God from moving outside of our comfort zone. We had nothing to fear. And in fact, that other communities, you know, so reading Merton, his writings about Buddhism, reading his spiritual writings about the mystery of God, a God who transcends all of our concepts, You know, in even in the Fire Watch, that famous essay of 1952, he's reflecting on the monastery that will one day burn down and be turned into ashes. Our churches, our monasteries, our constructs, our even our most cherished doctrines are of nothing as compared to the mystery of God. They do not exhaust the mystery of God. And so I think Merton initiated me into a world of wonder, a world of mystery. And he helped me to trust that I could move outside of my own comfort zones and be assured that I would find joy and happiness and sometimes great challenge, but always find the mystery of God hidden in those places if I were willing to take the risk. And so I think it was a disposition that he taught me, if you will, a contemplative disposition that is open to finding God in all things, as St. Ignatius would put it. I want to thank you again, Anne and Paul, and thank all of you for being here.
Yes, thank you so much for your words of wisdom today. And I'll turn it over to Dr. Pearson for the conclusion now.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for a truly inspiring and challenging presentation. You've left us all with much food for thought and hopefully for change and action. Certainly a lot of ideas for us all to take away from your presentation this afternoon. Thank you. Thank you also to Anne for so capably moderating the questions. And a special word of thanks to Adam Elias, the Director of Innovative Learning here at Bellarmine. Without his amazing assistance, this virtual event would not have been possible. Thank you, Adam. If you're inspired to read more about Merton and racism after today's lecture, there's an extensive bibliography available on the Merton Center's website, and I'll post the URL for that in the announcements and in the Q&A section. And many of the resources listed there are available online, including the audio of previous Merton Black History Month lectures. So there's a vast amount of some very good material there. And some of the previous speakers that Chris mentioned, you can hear some of them speaking through those resources. If you're interested in the work of the Merton Center, in our future events, or in the membership of the International Thomas Merton Society, then all the information you need about that can be found on the center's website at merton.org. So that just leaves me to thank you all for joining us this afternoon. And until we meet again, whether virtually or in person, stay safe, be well, and have a blessed week. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.